finish the Central Support Services Division. Debbie, if you don't mind doing that, we'll get that finished.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Lincoln, Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we covered most of the narrative on Central Support Services yesterday. I'll just summarize real briefly, starting on page 78 on the presentation document using the key issues section. What we are aiming at in the Director's Office, Building Administration Division, and the Information Management Division are to keep an eye on the building code system, continue the work that we started last interim with the Building Codes Division and all the stakeholders involved. We continue to staff the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which gets us involved in a policy around the balance of the workers' compensation system. We have in here that we're going to ensure quality health insurance. I don't think we can do that all by ourselves, but we're certainly partners in getting quality health insurance to all Oregonians in an affordable way. Internally, we're preparing for succession planning. We're always looking for a qualified, a diverse workforce, one that reflects Oregon's population. We're keen on ensuring that the department's programs get out and reach those other populations, people who've got limited English skills and whose cultural barriers may keep them from accessing government services. We are very much involved in providing easy-to-use e-commerce interfaces. We've got an awful lot of licensing, registration, consumer services, training, those kinds of things that can be done online, and we're in the forefront of bringing those applications up. We are working on electronic data interchange options, particularly in the workers' compensation system at the request and demand of the industry. We are working constantly on improving the quality of the department financial information so that policymakers have excellent information to make decisions on. With that, I'd like to ask Satish to go over our budget.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services. The Governor's recommended budget for the Central Support Division, this is a printed budget, is $31.1 million, other funds limited. This is a 3% increase from the 1999-2001 legislatively approved budget and a 0.8% increase from the current service level. The starting point for the budget is the 99-01 legislatively adopted budget, which consists of $29.2 million other funds and 187.5 full-time equivalent positions. There were two emergency board actions. The first action consisted of establishment of two positions. This is 1.65 full-time equivalent positions for information systems. And the limitation for these two positions is $236,655. The other emergency board action consisted of employee compensation cost increases. This consists of $780,415. And under the base budget adjustments, we have a total base budget adjustment of $1.4 million and a reduction of 2.27 full-time equivalent positions. With that, we have a base budget of $31.6 million and 186.88 full-time equivalent positions. Under the essential packages, there is an adjustment for vacancy savings with a reduction of $23,600, and there's also a non-fixed adjustment of $15,491. Under package O2O, there is a reduction of $250,000 from the base budget. This reflects a one-time cost for the purchase of an off-the-shelf licensing system. This did not take place, so we are doing a reduction. Under package O3O, you will see an increase of $284,551 for cost of goods and services and a decrease of $768,544 to reflect a decrease in state government service charges. With that, we have a current service level budget of $30.9 million, other funds limited, as well as 186.88 full-time equivalent positions. The Governor's recommended budget has one policy package, which would add two positions for risk management and human resources related services. This would add $254,351. At the request of the agency, there adjustments have been done to the recommended budget, which reduces the governor's recommended budget by $178,294 and two positions. One of the positions that is going to be reduced is from the policy package. Another position is from the base budget, and this is due to reduction in workers' compensation-related revenues. With that, we have a total governor's revised budget of $30.9 million total funds and 186.88 full-time equivalent positions. Now, this budget also has some non-limited funds. The non-limited funds consist of $1.6 million, and this is to pay for various collection charges by the department.
Thank you, Satish. Any questions? Representative Butler.
The collection, various collection charges of $1.609 million, what do those consist of, Mr. Claudia?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the department has to pay collection charges to the Department of Revenue as well as to the insurance companies, and it has to do with collection of insurance fees.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we have a number of unpaid debts. We have people who owe us fines, assessments, reimbursement for workers' comp claims, and we have a fairly large collection operation for those debts. We do pay the Department of Revenue. Once we try to collect the money and get to a certain point, we turn those over to the Department of Revenue, and at some point we can also bring in outside collection agents, and those are the costs for those collections.
Thank you very much, Sheriff, for that explanation. As I look at the 1999-2001 legislatively adopted budget of $29,187,000 on page 79, how much of that is personnel and the related cost of picks and personnel?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, around 71% of the governor's recommended budget is personal services, 28% is services and supplies, and around 1% is capital outlay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
And of the $1,017,000 of emergency board adjustments, an additional $780,000 was for contract adjustments, which is, if I said I've got $28,187,000, and 71% of that is labor, that's $20 million. $20,013,000 approximately dollars of labor. And if I take a look at $780,000 on $20 million, that represents nearly 4% increase. Did we not adjust in our 1999-01 legislatively adopted budget sufficiently for current service level?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, this is for the employee. The $780,415 is for employee cost compensation increases that you see in every agency's budget.
I appreciate that, Mr. Claudia, but didn't the 1999-01 legislatively adopted budget have a CSL in it?
Representative Butler, it did, but since this was an emergency board action, it has to come under, it's not part of the legislatively adopted budget. The legislatively adopted budget is what the 1999 legislature approved.
I appreciate
Madam
that.
Chair, members of the committee, that there is a central adjustment that is made. That is, that money is set aside, and I'm not sure whether it's in the e-fund or whether it's, I believe it is in the e-fund, and then the Department of Administrative Services comes back with a recommendation that those funds are then distributed, and what you see here is the distribution of the funds.
Is that the $40 million that we approved last session?
Yes.
Okay. But let me make sure that I'm still coming from the same direction, because I want to make sure that what I'm thinking is absolutely correct here. In the legislatively approved budget of $29,187,000, that would have been rolled up for all CSL costs. Is that correct? Which would include inflation and population served.
Go ahead, Lori.
First, I'm not going to answer. The CSL for the personal services, the continuing service level would include merit increases for employees that had scheduled merit increases, but there would be no cost of living or any contract, union contract increases included in that number.
Okay, so the CSL only took into consideration population increases, population being served, but not and merit increases, but not COLAs.
What was confusing me, Madam Chair and members, is that there is no automatic workload adjustment except for a few key agencies that have mandated caseload that gets adjusted. For the remainder, what you were seeing is roll-ups for inflationary adjustments and for merit increases, and then you see policy option packages to deal with workload. So it's so that the legislature gets to determine the level of additional staffing and that kind of thing for workload.
So just to finalize, so I'm certain here, so that really this 4% increase in compensation that was approved by the of the personal services portion of it, this 4% increase, which is the $780,000 on just the 71%, would be in effect. Basically, what we're saying is that then represents the cost of living that's given in addition to the merit increases, in addition to the workload. Any workload increases.
Representative Butler, you're correct, except for the workload.
Except for the workload. The workload may be included in the $780,000.
No, the workload, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair and members, the workload is included in the policy option packages that they have come forward and identified workload adjustments. What all you have in here are the roll-up for any merit increases and the approved adjustments for inflation, rent increases, those kinds of things.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just wanted this is a larger percentage than what I've seen in some other budgets, and that's why I wanted to make certain that the CSL did or did not include include the COLA last time.
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, I can talk to staff outside of the committee. In this discussion, I saw a lot of things included, not included in CSL, that I thought were included in CSL. I know that CSL is sort of squishy, but I thought a lot of the things that we're talking about were in it, and they're in addition to it, but I can discuss that later.
We may be using terminology a little bit differently, but I'd be glad to talk to you.
Just to follow up in that regard, policy option package 030, which is the cost of living for inflation and price list increases of $285,000, that isn't that we're adding now to the current to come up to the current CSL of $30,865,000, is that really isn't. It says based upon price list inflation 2.5%, rent and uniform rent increases, inflation for non-state contracts, and the inflation of the Attorney General. None of that is dealing with personnel issues.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. I think I explained it.
Any further questions?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we may want to just clarify the terms later on, the CSL and the base budget terms.
Not only the terms, but what is the compilation.
Yeah, but I don't have to hear much.
Okay, anything further? If not, we will go ahead with the building codes.
We still have a policy option package discussion, Madam Chair.
Okay,
copy real quick,
Madam
Chair.
We do have a policy option package. We withdrew half of that package. We we'll be able to, we've figured out how to do the safety, health, risk management duties and responsibilities internally. But I do want to emphasize the multicultural communications program. As I mentioned early in my discussion, those who speak English as a second language, or those who are just beginning to learn English, or those whose English is not very good, and those also who have cultural barriers to accessing government, are still Oregonians and still deserve government services. We feel pretty strongly that to be safe in the workplace, you've got to have an understanding of safety instructions and be able to read safety requirements. And to protect yourself from financial fraud, insurance problems, those kinds of things, you've got to understand the complexities of what's going on, and whether you speak English some or not at all, it's much easier to understand in your native language. So we have had over the last 3 years a program run by limited duration staff to do outreach to the Latino communities, and we're beginning to emphasize the Russian and Vietnamese communities as well, to advertise our programs, let people know they're out there. Since we started in 1997, we've had over 700% increase in the number of contacts, calls we've had from the Spanish-speaking community. Many, many of these are injured workers or workers who are trying to figure out the workers' compensation system, and most of them tell us that had they not had access in Spanish or had someone come out and tell them, speak to them in their own language and tell them what that services were, they would not have come to us. We think this is an extremely valuable program as the those populations grow in Oregon, and they are exploding. We think we need to keep this as a permanent program, and we are asking you for a position to do that. And that's the end of Central Services.
Any questions from Debbie on Central Support Services Division?
Madam Chair, relative to package 171, I think the last time I called the office, Debbie, there was an option to push the keypad for a Spanish explanation of what was going on. Does that reach an operator? Is that why we're adding the Spanish outreach? Is there just further instructions in Spanish for frequently asked questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that reaches a live person. Our receptionist is bilingual, and we hired a bilingual person specifically. If she is not available, it goes to the phone of the person who is currently filling this position on a limited duration basis, who speaks Spanish. It can also be transferred to two or three Spanish-speaking people in other areas of the department. The injured worker ombudsman, for example, has two Spanish-speaking people down there, and they are constantly busy with Spanish language calls.
So we still need one more with all of these people that we do have.
Madam Chair, President Butler, the program manager, the person who actually goes out and works with the community, is on board right now at the limited duration. We're asking for that to be permanent.
Further questions on the Central Support Services Division? Not. Thank you very much, Debbie, and we'll go on to the remaining issues with the Building Codes Division.
How, Madam Chair, how would you like us to proceed? I think your presentation is completed, so we can go through questions, or
let's go through questions and if we didn't have any other issues other than the issues on the detail, I guess, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we put on your desk yesterday, and I think there are additional copies today, a memo responding to some of the questions that were asked on, remember it was Wednesday, I believe it was. It's dated April 30th, questions from the April 24th hearing, and there is one legal page hanging out of that. Oh, Lori's giving you additional copies.
Thank you.
The first question was about appeals under Senate Bill 587, which allow for decisions of a building official, local building official, to be appealed to the State Building Codes Division. How many appeals we've had and how quickly we handle those. There's a summary on the first page, attachment one. We've only had one formal appeal, and that was taken within about 24 days. The other potential appeals that we have had have all been worked out before they got to the formal appeal stage. So at this point, we have had only one instance of appeal from a local building codes official's decision. Several questions were raised around the elevator program, and we have two attachments, attachments two and three, about the fees, the number of pays, the number of elevators that we have, how long it takes to inspect an elevator, and the workload levels. And I think what I'll do is ask you to take a look at those and ask questions. Dana Roberts, who manages that program as well as several others, is here and can go into more detail about those fees.
Madam Chair, I just had one question, if I may.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Butler.
I had someone mention to me that in addition to elevators, I noticed that dumbwaiters are also included here. even though those hoists may not be for lifting personnel, those are under the same strict guidelines as residential elevators.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer, Administrator at the Building Codes Division. Yes, Representative Butler, they're covered in the same ANSI code, but not to the same standard. There's separate standards for dumbwaiters, so they don't meet all the requirements of a residential elevator.
And there's some, Madam Chair, there's some kind of a proactive method of going out into the field and looking at these dumbwaiters and so forth. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the division is proactive with respect to identifying elevators, conveyances, and commercial industrial facilities that perhaps have either been red tagged or taken out of service and not kept out of service. But Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we do not actively pursue access to residential elevators. We do permit and inspect those, review the plans when we're notified, and if we find out about an illegal installation, we will go out and contact the owner. But no, we don't, for instance, go out and canvass for those units.
I'm sure the reason that I ask is I represent a district that has a lot of old buildings, not a lot of new downtown Portland high rises and those kinds of things. And I did have a constituent contact me relating to the fact that they did have, I think, other elevators in the business, not for lifting humans as much as for lifting product, augers, and those kinds of things. And there was a dumbwaiter in the building that had been sealed off at one particular end. It had never been used in the 50 or 60 years these people had been in the business. And they were fined as a result of the fact that it wasn't sealed off in the basement. So you had to seal the thing off and dismantle and take it apart. And rather than do that, sealing it off up above. And I would hope that whoever our elevator inspection and permitting person or persons are, that they would use just a little bit of common sense when they see a dumbwaiter or something that would be for back from the time when people move product between upper floors and lower floors by putting seeds or cans of spray or cans of buckets of paint or whatever they were on a hand auger or a hand pulley type of a waiter up and down, that even though those things are long since no longer used because of the sprinkling requirements, if they were to use upper and lower floors and all of the rest of the stairway and other OSHA requirements for access, that if the dumbwaiter is obviously no longer in use, that we at least be able to use a little common sense. I'm not after a lot. I just need a little in buildings that are over 50 years old. And that's all I'm asking.
I think you have a very valid point, Representative Butler. Those of us who are trying very hard to heal the split between urban and rural Oregon realize that many of the things happen with just the kind of example you use. And when I was raising hogs and got a fine from Oral Schiffer fans that didn't have a screen on them on the outside and 4 miles from the nearest human being and all fenced off because it was a specific pathogen-free, which means no one can come onto the property unless they take a shower and get into white coveralls and go through a foot bath. That motivated me to get into government. Here I sit and I hear the same thing. So I think what we need is an understanding of how things are utilized in rural Oregon, and when they're not utilized, that we don't need fines. I go back to thinking of the person that came in and testified on Oral Ushaba when I was sitting here some time ago and said that they, because they had a violation of soldering irons on their shop floor, the investigator nailed the fine to a tire on a tractor. So, you know, a little common sense goes a long ways. Those tire tractors are pretty expensive, and why you would nail that there. The building was metal, so there was no place to put the fine except to nail it to a tire.
He didn't nail it to his forehead.
Yeah. Well, he might have if they'd found the farmer home, but he was on another tractor in the field. But those kinds of things are what really make rural folks all incensed. A little bit of explanation about what you've done wrong or how you need to handle something goes a long way.
Or just an observation, you know, that perhaps the, you know, that it could be sealed off downstairs as well, so nobody could try and run the old ancient pulleys or something of that nature. But the downstairs wasn't even being used. So,
well, or some sort of work where we let people know that there's something wrong rather than just walk in with a fine. I think if they've mm-hmm. been notified, given notice that they have a problem, there's a law that has to be done a different way. And then if they come back and find that it hasn't been followed through, that just a fine, but certainly not on a first-time inspection.
The only reason I bring it up is the cost of elevator inspections and workload levels are indicated in the attachments. And I'm saying if the workload includes going around and sniffing for those kinds of things, that's not, that I wouldn't be considering that part of the workload.
We are on the building codes division. Remaining issues, any other comments? Not. Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you.
Joe. Next, we will well, I think what I did was open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5507 because we didn't have a quorum at that time, so I will close that and open a public hearing, or actually a work session on Senate Bill 5508 and Senate Bill 5507. And for the members of the committee, the Senate goes into session at 10:30 and the House goes in at 10, but Robin has the House members excused till 10:30 if we can get our work done on these two bills.
Telephone. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, you should see before you a memo from me about the C-bill, Senate Bill 5508. There's a couple pieces of paper under it, too.
This is dated May the 1st.
May the 1st.
Thank you.
Yes.
And, Lori, you are so efficient. But you go so fast sometimes, I lose you. Do you know what farm terminology, being in compound means?
No.
It's the very lowest gear a truck has. If you go in compound today, I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best to go in compound.
Pretend you're a truck. Okay.
I try not to be frantic on purpose, but it's kind of natural. The memo has recommendations regarding the C-bill, which we did discuss in some detail last week.
The first recommendation from the Legislative Fiscal Office is to approve the Dash One Amendment, which added the fees for the medical gas system inspections. Those fees have been left off inadvertently from the original bill. If you'll look on the fee matrix, which is attached or underneath that memo, the medical gas systems are on page 506 towards the very bottom where it says excluded from Senate Bill 5508. And this is the fee that would be included with the amendment. These are new fees that were put into place as a result of the legislation from the 1999 session. Fee for the medical gas system is $190 for a base fee and then an additional dollar for each inlet or outlet in the system.
We didn't hear any testimony from any of the groups this affects, Lori. Is there no opposition at all?
There is no opposition that I'm aware of, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dukes.
Just for my curiosity, medical gas, is this, are we talking clinics? Medical clinics?
That's my understanding, Senator Dukes. If the committee would like more detail.
Okay. Gas would be to heat the building or to put the patient out?
Joe, my assumption was oxygen and other
medical gas.
Medical gas.
Gas.
That is probably you would know.
It says medical gas.
Yeah.
I think that's butane to heat medical offices.
From the outside, it could be any of the above.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. The medical gas systems are those systems delivering bottled gases directly to the patient. Nitrous oxide, if you're in the dentist's office, might be oxygen in the hospital. The last legislature decided that that should be plumbing and that individuals should be trained and licensed in how to do the installations properly.
Any further questions on that?
But, Madam Chair, we're not too clear about the procedures, but we really know what the fee should be. So let's go ahead.
Madam Chair?
Senator Duke.
How often do we inspect these things?
Joe, you may as well stay out here until we get this.
Yes, Madam Chair.
How often do we inspect these?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, these installations are inspected at the time of the installation. So a permit is purchased. The inspectors and the installers are all trained to the same standard, and an inspection is performed at the time that the system is complete.
So House Bill 3384 that was passed in 99 mandated this. Did we not inspect these before? Or said that they had to be licensed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, the state didn't regulate this area in any sense. I believe there was some regulation from the standpoint of perhaps a standard set, and I'm really going from memory now, by the Fire Marshal's Office. But again, it was decided that these systems are plumbing in essence and should be designed and installed to specific standards.
Further questions?
I know, Madam Chair, I know that there's been a course taught this past week, I think, here in the metropolitan area on those, because my rural inspectors are and building officials are all coming in from rural Oregon to Portland, I think it was, this past week to be here in Portland.
Okay.
So I know that there are, and that now that we have, that portion of it, the base fee, that there is an inspection that's on top of that as well. Now, it was 190 base plus how much per fixture?
A dollar per inlet or outlet.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, it's a solution looking for a problem that doesn't exist, actually. I put in a couple of these systems. You call up a competent local plumber. I can give you a name. They come and they do the they solder the pipes, and the skill comes in delivering the appropriate amount of gas to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come with the plumbing. And the medical gases are no longer flammable. We don't use flammable gases. Oxygen will burn,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't explode. So this, I don't see any particular reason for this fee, but I'll vote for it.
Who introduced House Bill 3384? Joe, do you know?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my recollection is that the bill was introduced by, if I recall correctly, plumbing, heating, cooling contractors.
Another question.
Okay, any other discussion on the LFO recommendation of approving the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dukes?
There's no opposition because people who are going to need this don't necessarily know they're going to need it yet. We're feeing somebody who doesn't exist yet.
Well, those who have been installed wrong are no longer with us.
Well, that's not comforting.
but in a much happier sphere.
Madam
Chair, I would move, as we are in work session,
yes.
We do have a full complement at this point relative to a quorum, that we approve the Dash 1 amendment to add the fees for the medical gas system inspections, which has been mistaken in the original bill.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Discussion? Any objection to Representative Butler's motion? So moved.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the next recommendation relates to a topic that we've had considerable discussion on, the two fees for the pawnbrokers. The LFO recommendation is to not approve the two pawnbroker fees and adopt the following budget note. The subcommittee did not approve the proposed increases in the annual activity and assessment fees for the pawnbroker program based on expected passage of legislation that will draw related businesses into the program. With additional licensees, the Department of Consumer and Business Services anticipates that an annual fee of $250 will cover program costs. The subcommittee directed the department to report to the emergency board prior to January 2003 on the number of licensees, program activities, expenditures, and the level of fees needed to fund the program. You also find in the staff lawyer memo a copy of legislation that, well, a copy of the Pawnbrokers Act, as well as changes, proposed changes to the statutes that would bring additional businesses under the pawnbroker program. There is a bill, House Bill 3978, that has been introduced, and I believe members of this subcommittee were willing to work with the committee that bill gets assigned to try and implement these changes and get some amendments to that bill that will bring these businesses in.
Thank you, Lori.
Madam Chair, I just want to express my appreciation for Senator Dukes and Representative Hayden working on this particular issue and getting to the bottom of it, as well as Mr. Kruger, Jim Kruger, who is by default directing this pawnbroker end of it right now, and who has given us the assistance to where we're at today. So I'd like to express my appreciation and to those folks, and probably it's up to one of them to go ahead and make a motion as to the second bullet.
Representative Hayden?
Madam Chair, would you accept a motion saying that I move that we approve the recommendation of staff as to the pawnbroker's fees dated on the memorandum dated May 1, 2001, or do you want me to read that?
No, that's fine, Representative Hayden. I think we have it all before us, do we not? And I would like to add my thanks as well to Representative Hayden and Representative Butler and Senator Dukes, and obviously to Mr. Kruger as well and the department for working with us on this issue. I need a further discussion. Any objection to Representative Hayden's motion? Not so approved. Lori?
The next recommendation is to approve the remaining fees on the fee matrix for building codes, Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and the Insurance Division. We briefly went through these the other day. There are fees for several programs in the Building Codes Division, including boiler and pressure vessel system fees, manufactured dwelling program fees, plumbing program fees, Building Codes Tri-County Services Center program fees, and elevator program fees, which were detailed in the information from the department that we briefly looked at this morning.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Now that we're on the verge of voting on these fee bills, I just am looking for reassurance again that the constituent groups that these fees affect have had some role, or at least are aware of the fact that this is happening. Now, I know that we have heard from some of the constituent groups, for example, mobile home folks came in and shared some opinions about this. But this is a pretty comprehensive list of fee increases, and I'm just looking for some assurance that the affected parties have been ideally drawn into the process and, somewhat short of that, at least notified.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the fees that are outlined in the list that you have all been through a number of public hearings. They've all had advisory committees, of which the industry was a part. And to my recollection, the industry has supported each and every fee increase we've requested.
Well, let me just say, I come from an industry that last session came to the legislature and asked to have fees increased on themselves. And those were for very specific purposes to help provide improvements. It happened to be aviation related. Those fees are restricted to improvements on airports throughout Oregon. And the industry itself stepped forward and said, please raise the fees and use them for these purposes. I'm very supportive of that. And I rely on your representation that there were advisory groups, industry was involved. There's been a very public process that has led us to this extensive matrix.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's accurate.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we discussed earlier, how easy it is for perhaps a general contractor to advocate on behalf of an electrician's journeyman's license being increased substantially, and I think that's a great idea. You know, the best fee in the world is one that charges somebody else. and so I think that the folks that come forward and advocate, particularly to those fees that eventually will be borne by the people who are using these services, whether they be for the elevators or whether they be for the delivery of nitrous oxide gases. I mean, it's easy enough for us to say, but the bottom line is that ultimately we will pay these one way or another. However, that having been said, relative to the manufactured dwelling program fee, the movement of that fee from $30 to $40 and making that retroactive back to 10100 or to 12100 or whatever date that it was finally finished out where everyone was charging us throughout the state. I was here last session when Senator Dukes, I guess, would have been here at that time too, when we moved that fee from $20 to $30. It's got about a 25-month life to it that it's gone from $20 to $40. And that fee is only really borne by one group of people, and that's people who are in the process of getting any kind of a transaction done relative to a mobile home. And so I, in visiting with Ms. Lincoln yesterday, I questioned some of the costs and some of the charges, particularly within the OVCD. And I've got a dollar upstairs that I'm going to stick in. I finally found the first dollar I ever earned, and I'll bring it down, and you'll see that it will go into the piggy bank. I've been using a lot of acronyms. I probably owe more than the first dollar I ever earned, too. But I finally found it.
Okay, we'll probably be charging interest.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll run upstairs and get a drink break. But the central services charge to OVCD, because of the number of divisions, we discussed that from the large book, and I'm hoping that there's some efficiencies that can be found in the department that will at least equal, if not exceed, the $85,000 that this fee raises. And therefore, I would like to propose that we remove that fee from this time forward, vote forward.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had discussed yesterday whether or not you wanted the industry to speak to that issue and what the funding is used for. Mr. Miner is here. If the committee...
Don, would you come on up, please?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. The fee that you're speaking to, as I understand it, deals with it benefits directly consumers. Previous to the creation of this program, if a consumer had a complaint, he was kind of caught in an awkward position where if you blame the manufacturer would say it was the dealer would say it was the installer, and they'd all point fingers at each other. The fee, or the program funded by this fee, is allows a consumer to contact the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon will send an inspector at no cost, no additional cost, and that inspector will look at the home and make a determination on the spot as to what needs to be done and who has to do it. If it's a problem with the construction of the home, they'll order that the factory fix it. If it's a problem with installation or transportation, they'll order that the correct party make that repair. The industry actually is the ones who propose the creation of this program. We see it as a way to bring about better consumer satisfaction. And actually, we think it reduces our costs by solving problems early without litigation. In addition to that, it's not just a corrective program. While that inspector is in the field, they invite all of the parties to the transaction, the consumer, the factory, the installer, the local government officials, and they use that as an opportunity to provide training so that the mistake isn't created in the future or isn't repeated in the future. So we very much support this program. All of our programs are fee-supported. We've had a tremendous fall-off in our volume. You wind up with some fixed costs, unfortunately, and so we've had to increase these fees. All the fees were increased after being reviewed by the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board, which is has manufacturers on it, has installers on it, has a retailer on it, has consumers on it. In fact, the legislature has put into a law a requirement that no fee on our program be increased without their approval. So even though it's an advisory board, they have fee approval authority. So this is it's a fee that's supported by the industry. We think it benefits consumers. Hopefully when our volumes pick back up, these fees will go down. Thank you.
Question to Don. Don, this fee is being added to benefit the consumer, and that ultimately is charged the consumer, and you also alluded to the fact that your volume is going down, the volume of construction is going down. Can you tell us approximately how much the volume has gone down over the last, since 1998, for instance?
Probably 50%.
50%?
Huge fall off in volume.
And during that time, does it appear that we're charging more or less for fees for these kinds of things per unit?
The fees per unit have gone up. But still, it's a relative bargain to have, you know, a manufactured home inspected, whether if you add all of the fees, the implant fees, the installation fees, even the fees added or charged by local government, my guess is we're probably in the $500 to $700 range for a single family dwelling, could be more. If you go and look at a site built single family dwelling, the costs are substantially higher. So it's a relative bargain no matter how you look at it. If I could go back to this program, the industry has come under a great deal of criticism in the press lately. I've been around about 20 years, 21 years. In previous years, if you go way back, the concerns would have and the criticisms would have addressed the quality of the homes. There would have been complaints about the setup, the construction. If you read those articles recently very carefully, there was no criticism in that regard. We think that it's due in large measure to better inspections, also better training of the industry. We think we've nailed that part of our issues, taking care of all those issues. So,
Madam Chair, follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, the fees that were increased 27, 28 months before this, That was supposed to be for a portion of the training and inspection fees there. That $10 wasn't enough, and that's why we're adding the second $10.
I believe that's true. Several legislatures ago, we had a very large ending balance in our program. I think it was like about $1.2 million or $1.3 million. The legislature saw fit to reduce fees, give that money back to the industry. Actually, our preference would have been to have let the money ride. Considering the cyclical nature of housing, you knew sooner or later we were going to need the money. And we don't have a large balance, or went into this downturn without a large balance. And so that explains it. But this has been widely reviewed by the industry. All manufacturers were given heads up.
Madam Chair, relative to the ending balance, let me ask this question of Debbie. We, after having reviewed some of the charges that are being levied against the OVCD by the Central Support Division, do you still feel like that we can save money from the charges that are being levied?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Butler is referring to an effort we are making to streamline building codes accounting process. Building codes, as you've seen, has a lot of fees, something like 500. The Business Administration Division charges a certain rate per accounting transaction to all the divisions. And because their accounting transactions have been high, it has been fairly expensive for them. So we're trying to, and I think we'll succeed in streamlining that accounting process and thereby lowering the fees that the Business Administration Division charges to building codes over the next biennium. We're also looking at streamlining charges from the Information Management Division. So yes, we are making a huge effort, partly at the instigation of Don and the manufactured housing folks who raised that issue, as well as a number of other stakeholders, as we're looking at going into a downturn.
Madam Chair, my point is this. I think the figure that Debbie used yesterday was that by streamlining the fees within the agency, that there's potential savings of up to $500,000. And whether or not that's realized is dependent largely upon the streamlining that's done and how quickly. But I'm looking at the $85,000 now, and that's at 50% of where we were just within the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And Don, you testified to the fact that this takes care of a lot of the finger pointing that it's somebody else's responsibility, but there's a person at the table right now who's actually used the service of trying to come to OBCD and having a question relative to a mobile home and the manufacture of a mobile home versus the installation and those kinds of things very satisfactorily, and it wasn't under the current charge. So I guess what I'm saying is I feel like that there must be some water getting to the end of the row, and perhaps the money that was charged 2 years ago, which we approved in the last legislative session, which was in fact a 50% increase at that point, which now by adding this second $10 gives us a 50% increase effectively over the last, or 100% increase over the last 2 years. And I feel like at this particular point this can be accomplished. The training and the inspection can be accomplished within the current budget for the manufactured homes within the division by not charging the additional $10 and not collecting an additional $85,500, anticipating that people will be moving more to mobile homes, modular homes, as the economy goes down, we hope.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the DCPS has been, I think, very cooperative in examining the overhead assessed to manufactured housing, has found considerable economies. Some of the accounting costs were actually probably even my fault over the years as we've added programs. I've always thought it prudent to create a separate sub-account. Not sure how I got that notion. I assumed it was free.
In the matrix, Don. It would go blind if you had to work out of there.
So, but there are considerable savings have been found and passed back to the industry over both this and the coming biennium, as I understand it. But even considering those costs, it's my understanding that we will end with just a few hundred thousand dollars in our ending balance. So I think the industry really is in a very precarious position in terms of its funding. We would like to continue our services, recognize that there are maybe additional efficiencies that could be found, but this is a fairly basic program for us.
Well, President Butler discussed streamlining, and Mr. Miner was talking about the various fees that are assessed against a mobile home. Who pays those? Does the contractor installer pay all those fees, or does the consumer write five or six different checks? How do those get paid?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, generally those fees are paid by the manufacturer, the installer, and the consumer will pay additional fees when they take out, if they take out the installation permit. The fees will be built into that. But various folks, installers buy tags to install homes.
How many checks does the consumer have to write to get a mobile home installed, other than the cost of the building? I mean, for fees.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I believe one to the local official or to the state if the state provides that service.
Just a question relative to the number of FTE. Again, we go through, and I think this was in another division here where we were talking about the ergonomics of the green chains, and we had four lovely ladies that came before us and said, you know, we need to continue on with this ergonomic program because if we don't, we'll lose over $200,000 of federal money. And it's imperative that we maintain the ergonomic program. Now we did cut back on some of the ergonomic positions, but kept the supervisors. We're in a situation here where we've got a 50% downturn potentially in the modular home market, and if we were to go back behind and take a look at the number of FTE in this particular division, Building Codes Division, as the modular home portion of it, have we really taken a reduction of 50% of the personnel, or even 25% of the personnel who are serving the modular home portion of it? I would think that would be something that you'd really want to be looking at.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, in this particular program, FTE has been cut by two. We were at six in 1998. We're at four today, and expect to admit that really is a skeleton crew for this consumer assistance program.
So the 173 FTE, only four people are manufactured homes?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I apologize. I didn't mean to imply that. The overall manufactured home program during that time has been reduced from 24 inspectors to 14. We have four of those 14 performing other duties. So currently there are 10 individuals in the manufactured home program, four of which are in the state administrative assistance program, which is what this program is. This is a program that comes along with our mandate from the federal government. It is staffed adequately at four to do the job, given the level of production that's in the plants today.
Madam Chair, I just have difficulty, in an operation that's decreased by 50% in this many years. Having an increase in fees and a decrease in personnel and an increase in fees, and I guess the rest of it must go into administration and COLAs and those kinds of things, which we have very little control over other than just this fee issue. And I still feel very strongly that I thought that the $10 that we saw that we approved retroactively to July of 98, the last time we were in session, in a 99-01 session, was a 50% increase and was plenty to get us through, and particularly with the downturn in the market. To have this additional what constitutes now the remainder of 100% increase, an additional 50% increase, which is all borne by a group of people who will be purchasing modular units over the next biennium, and assuming there's no increase, over maybe a couple of biennium, and I feel like that it's not going to break their backs, but it's something that I think could be covered out of the current service level. I just am proposing that as an item of discussion for the members of the committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Further discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, that population would be senior citizens and first-time home buyers and young people, and those least able to afford any additional expenses.
Madam Chair, can I make a suggestion? My suggestion would be that you not ratify this particular fee increase, and that we be instructed to come back to the emergency board and report on the manufactured homes program fee levels within the next 6 months or so, and let you know how their balance is looking and whether we're getting close to the bottom.
Debbie, I appreciate your suggestion, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Can you break out the modular home, the mobile home portion of it, Debbie, so that I know that there are, within the OBCD, there are multiple charges for each division, and if we could break out both the fees, not just these fees, but all of the mobile home fees and all of the mobile home overhead costs, and pull this $85,500 fee increase out now, I think I would support the recommendation of Deputy Director Lincoln.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, yes, we're required to keep all those, as we said, accounts in separate buckets, and we can give you all the detail on manufactured homes and the other accounts as well.
I'd like also the name of whoever it is that does all of that work. I've got to meet a person that's more animal than I am. Because that is
going to be a terrible
that is,
job.
That is a
Madam Chair,
job.
Representative Butler, Dana, would you stand up? he's one of several.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, all of the fees on this list are fees that have already been implemented, and so our approval is requested retroactively. What happens if we don't approve one?
Right there at that particular point.
At this point, it doesn't. I mean, it seems as though we're saying, no, you shouldn't have increased this one back whenever you increased it.
Madam Chair, Representative Thunder Dukes, we would have to immediately eliminate the fee increase, go back to our previous amount. And since we haven't done this before, I would have to explore whether or not we'd have to refund the additional $10 that has already been paid. I'm pretty sure we do.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could also, the fee has been increased, so folks have adjusted to it, too. If the fee is then decreased, and then later it's found to have been warranted, it's then, no one will ever remember the fee decrease. They only remember the fee increases. So the memory will be that every time they turn around, this fee has been increased. That's the practicality of it. I understand the willingness of the agency to look at that, but it's then embarrassing for us to go to our folks and say, we're increasing your fees again. That's
Billy, is there some way in the future that the agency's fee increase can somehow coincide with a legislative session? I mean, it's a little tough to go in and look at fees that have already been increased and people are already paying and then determine whether or not we need to continue them or not.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, because of the... Oh, we're just getting word that we don't have to refund, but I'd have to pin that down. Because we have so many fees, I don't know what to say. In terms of trying to raise fees only at a legislative session, and in some kind of statutory way. It would be...
Meaning statutory. I mean, if fees just became effective July 1st.
July 1st of every year. Or,
yeah, or every other year since you're funding it. I mean, there's certainly going to have to be adjustments if suddenly you're not getting enough income. But even at that, you could go back and work with an emergency board. It's awkward to go and try to approve things retroactively.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, in the case of these particular fees, I certainly appreciate what you're saying, and we can work to do that, do our best to manage in that respect. In the case of these fees, I don't think anyone could have anticipated the precipitous fall that's taken place in demand for manufactured housing. This really is unprecedented to see production drop. Don says 50%. I think it's more like 60% in a relatively short period of time. So I understand your point, and certainly we'll work very hard to try and do that in the future.
But you can't anticipate a conservative legislature.
Yes.
Johnson and Representative Butler.
I have a freshman question and a process question. Why is it that in the context of the Ways and Means, we have had very stern words from one of the co-chairs about retroactive agency requests for grants, where we're actually having money coming into the state that's federal money, and in this instance, we're approving retroactive fees that are actually costing Oregonians money? I see a disconnect, and I'm looking for some guidance to reconcile that.
Madam Chair, can I speak to this? This agency and many other agencies have statutory authority to increase their fees. A process was set in place in 1995, in a Senate bill that required legislative oversight of the establishment or increase of fees. And so agencies that have the authority to establish their fees can establish or increase those fees in the interim, and then are required under this process to come back and seek ratification from the legislature. So what you have in front of you is an agency with authority to increase fees that is seeking ratification under a process that was established by the legislature.
With respect, that seems a little odd.
Visit that process if they choose.
Butler and then Representative Hayden.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the discussion relative to the 1995 Senate Bill 333, which gives us an opportunity to come back and revisit these. And this I think is an excellent case in point as to why we revisit them, because there are changes sometimes within the market and changes within the overall situation that sometimes the legislature can look at it and say, I don't know that we can sell that to our constituencies.
Is that your bill that I just...
No. I appreciate it. But the bottom line is that this is a... And Lori and Robin have a pretty good grasp of what it is that we go back and try and accomplish, but it is a retroactive in its nature. And again... With a dramatic change in the market, you just don't know those are going to happen when they were proposed. And this I shared some of the releases from the department with Legislative Fiscal yesterday relative to this particular fee. It was supposed to have been effective 10/1/00, and because all building officials were not notified timely, appropriately, or at all. Not all of them were collecting it on 10/1, and there was a kind of a disconnect, and some were collecting at 10/1, some at 11/1, and some at 12/1, and I think finally it came into being right at the end of the year of this past year, I mean, fully implemented. So, and then if I could just say one other comment, was that at one time in a building inspection program that I'm aware of, they allowed a pilot program. Then when the pilot program was ceased, then they said, well, refund the fees to everyone that are presently in the process of the pilot program. You don't refund them to the ones historical. You just, those that are in the process, because we've terminated the pilot program. And so they had only collected, I think, from a total of 12 people, the pilot program fee. They said, if it can't be approved retroactively, there are only 12 people, and we want to maintain good relationship with the 12 buyers, not just the four that were and the contractors is what you're doing, not just the four contractors who paid it presently that were working on open building permits, but for those other eight, which includes some of the four right now, we're going to refund the whole thing. And they had the right to do that. It was a private inspection program. So they're not required to go back retroactively on those permits and refund them.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Hayden.
Well, Matt, this is an interesting discussion. It seems to me that all these fees are in fact prospective in nature. I mean, they establish a fee and they seldom say, well, you have to pay us for the last 2 years too. The fee is prospective. In the future, you must pay it. It is the legislative review that is retrospective. Now, if we could get on the same page and have agencies come in and say, we want to charge these fees in the future, prospective, and establish those fees at a time when the legislature could review it, have some oversight prospectively, then it would work much more smoothly. Not only do we have this problem of retrospective ratification with fees, but we have it with reclassifications, and in some of the Ways and Means subcommittees, there has been some discussion and some denial of retrospective reclassification, because the problem is that the agency will reclassify the position or charge the fee 20 minutes after the legislature leaves town, and so it's 18 months until the next, and the fee or the reclassification of the salary has been the position for some time. So I don't see why it would be such a difficult thing to set these up, saying on July 1 of 2003, such and such a fee will go into effect for the agencies that have statutory authority to do that. There's one more thought, but it's not coming up.
This is not that easy.
We'll come back to it.
Representative Butler.
Go ahead if you're on this one. I have something else.
Madam Chair,
We just passed such a bill on the House last week, and it is coming to the Senate, where a reclassification was denied, a retrospective, and you will be voting on that on the Senate floor.
Thank you for the heads up on that, Senator Dukes.
Earlier, Representative Butler mentioned the electrical fees, and my understanding is they are not a part of this. And so I just wanted to know if when we finish this, if we would have an opportunity to talk about those. They are part of the budget. They're not a part of the fee list that we have in front of us, if I understand things correctly.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't believe that those revenues aren't included in the budget at this point.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, they are. The budget is predicated on that 25% fee increase. It is prospective. It is also actually in your packet, the big packet that we had started on this morning. There was some information on that. It is.
I didn't mean to get into it now because we're on the list. I just wanted an opportunity to get into it at this point.
That's fine. It's attachment 5. And the industry has proposed House Bill 3088, which increases journeyman license fees and contractor fees, as you see there. The revenue that would raise would eliminate the need for the increase that we had put originally in the budget. The page right before that you just had in your hand compares electrical fees in various jurisdictions, both the current fee, which we expect to continue now because we expect 3088 to pass, and the fee with the plus 25% to jurisdictions around the state.
Madam Chair, my concern is that we don't know what's going to happen, and the budget is predicated on a 25% increase in journeyman electrical licenses. And no, it's on permit fees, excuse me. 3088 shifts it off to licenses for contractors and journeymen, but it's predicated upon a permit fee, an electrical inspection permit fee, or installation permit fee, and a 25% increase is a pretty significant increase. And I objected to it when it first came, and now I'm looking at the comparisons for... we had the discussion the other day about they can only affect the... or this increase will only apply to the programs that they run, which are the rural programs. And I'm looking at these to where a residential permit for 1,000 square feet or less will become, with this increase, $132. Whereas if you're in Bend, you're going to pay $85. If you're in Corvallis, you're going to pay $85. And granted, in Eugene, you're going to pay a little bit more. Because they don't control those programs. They don't run those programs. But even so, in Florence, you're going to pay $110, which is less. In Washington County, $110. In Portland, $155, which is a little bit more. And I'm just having a tough time, first, with a 25% increase, and secondly, with how much more it's going to take for somebody in, and I'm guessing here, Ontario, than somebody in Bend. I'm guessing they run the Ontario program. I don't know that. And all of these seem to be coming out that way. I mean, temporary service or feeder for 200 amps or less, we're suddenly going to be paying $62.50. And the only one that two that I can see are higher than that is Eugene's going to pay $65 and Portland $66. Clearly, their cost of living is higher in those areas. And so I'm really concerned about this. And if 3088 passes, then one of those fees can be passed on, the other one can't really. But if it doesn't pass, then this budget is predicated upon these fees, and I'm not happy with that.
And Chair, can I ask a question relative to of fiscal and of Ms. Lincoln and Mr. Brewer? Are we passing on 25% worth of additional fees because we have 25% more work and more complexity, or are we passing upon 25% more fees because we have the same amount of staff but just less work and less money coming in, so we've got to make each one more? I mean, that's like the guy that invented the typewriter that said, you know, he had $1 million into it, and what he was going to do is just going to sell one of them for $1 million and get his money back. Or he could sell, you know, a whole bunch of them for less money and spread it around. And that's where I was wanting to go with this. If we're truly increasing a value to a lesser number of people, then there might be a reason for an increase.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there are several elements rolled into the increase in cost with respect to electrical inspections. Major element being the increase in pay for inspectors and for chief inspectors, so forth and so on. We had difficulties recruiting and retaining qualified staff. We weren't paying at a level that was competitive with any of the jurisdictions around us, and we were unable to retain and obtain qualified people. Secondly, the cost of providing service as a provider of last resort is significantly greater than the cost to other jurisdictions. Our travel time averages as much as 40% of our inspector's time behind the wheel, driving from one inspection to the other. We've talked about the fact that the division serves very few population centers. I was incorrect in my testimony and acknowledged that to Senator Dukes. We do, in fact, provide service now for the city of Astoria. But again, we have very few of those population centers. So where you see a Washington County compared to the state, Washington County has a much lower level of drive time, windshield time, to perform inspections than we do. Those are the major elements that are tied into this. 74%, I believe, of our budget is personnel related. It's the cost of keeping qualified inspectors on staff and the cost of supporting their activities.
Washington County also has a higher cost of living, a higher CPI and all of that. Rural communities, I mean, all we're doing is raising the cost of getting a home. Now,
one little fee doesn't make that much difference, although this isn't one little fee. There's a whole long list of them here. All add up to it. And I guess if it were, you know, 10-15%, I wouldn't have worried about it. Somebody should have noticed that the program was getting more expensive and done it maybe incrementally. It's just to raise it by a quarter, by 25%, seems a lot all at once to me.
Madam Chair, can I respond to that? I think the issues that we deal with are timeliness. It's expensive. It may raise the cost of a home, but having a contractor sit around for 2 or 3 weeks waiting for an inspector to get there raises the cost of the home even more. The other, and we talked about this before, raising a fee, a huge percentage, instead of coming in every couple of years with a fee increase. And I'm hearing two different things. Representative Butler didn't like for us to go from 20 to 30 to 40, which is raising it incrementally, and yet when we do make a big jump, that's not accepted either. So I'm a little confused on whether you want us to raise these incrementally every few years or if you want us to take big jumps.
Saying, Debbie, is when it comes to raising fees, that one of our jobs is to question whether or not you really need the fee increase?
I absolutely agree, Senator Deuce, and that's why we're here. But we're trying to make a case that we have managed these fees, I think, responsibly and professionally over the years. We respond very quickly to our industries, and these fee increases are a result of that, and that's why we bring them in front of you so that you can take a look at them.
Madam Chair, there are two other options that the Deputy Director doesn't mention. She mentioned incremental fee increases or massive fee increases. There's also the status quo and fee decreases. And in an age of technology with computers and efficiency, occasionally you would think a fee could be decreased.
Madam Chairman, Representative Hayden, we have decreased fees over the years, and we've got we can bring back that information. When we had high ending balances, as Don mentioned, we decreased the manufactured housing fees, we decreased the plumbing fees, we did decrease the boiler fees, electrical fees went down at one point, and now we're at the end of our ending balance. What you see here is just a portion of our fees. As I said, the Building Codes Division alone has more than 500, so the rest of those fees are staying static. So I think we are making use of all four of those options.
Debbie, with everybody's permission, what I'd like to do, if it's all right, if we go back to the fee bill and see if we can finalize that, and Senator Dukes, when we go to the Senate Bill 5507 work session, we'll have you address your concerns there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just real briefly, there are other fees besides Building Code Division fees on this fee list. If you'll turn to page 5 of 6, you'll see that there are some fees related to the Insurance Division program. And I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of fees or fee changes in the middle of that page, which actually do reduce fees because they change the renewal cycle for insurance agent licensing, just to show that there are times when fees are decreased downward or fee structures are changed that reduce costs to those people paying the fees. I just wanted to point that out. And there were, on the previous page, there's a fee at the very top of page 5 that relates to the collection agency program. So those are a couple other fees that are not related to building codes that are on this list.
Okay, Representative Butler. Thank you. Madam Chair, I move that we approve the remaining fees for Building Codes Division, Finance and Corporate Securities in the Insurance Division, and those other fees, with the exception of the State Code for Development Training and Monitoring fee increase relative to Manufactured Dwelling Program fees, which is scheduled from $30 to $40, which is effective sometime on or after 10-1 double aught.
You've heard Representative Butler's motion. Discussion? Representative Hayden.
Just to comment, Madam Chair, that it's a striking figure that there are 500 fees for this one division and hundreds of divisions with, I suppose, hundreds of thousands of fees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Carry on.
That's fee for every socket in the wall.
Yes, And Representative Butler, I believe the director mentioned that if you wanted to make that motion and then have them come back to the emergency board, would
yes.
you add that
to your
motion?
I beg your pardon. Yes, Madam Chair. I neglected to add that that we would like to have then a budget note to include the return of the agency back to the emergency board in the interim with a complete analysis of the building codes, and perhaps that would be in relationship to some of the other charges, central services charges that are presently being worked through as well, so that we could at that time have a report from the deputy director and or the director and staff relative to the overall fee structure, and if the building crash continues, then we'll just have to monitor it at that time as well.
Robin. You've heard the motion before us. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. And now we'll go into we need to
wrap it up and move it.
We need to move it to
as
a motion.
Is that the last of all of the issues, Madam Chair?
On the building,
on the 5508? On all of 5508? We've cleared everything else up. Madam Chair, if we've taken care of everything, and I'm going to, I just went through it this morning, but if Legislative Fiscal Office says that we've taken care of each one of those items, I would move now that we move Senate Bill 5508 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
When you're ready for discussion.
Discussion.
I do have one question on the pawnbrokers program fees.
Took it all on.
We took them all out. Both of these?
Yeah, both of these.
And was there a third fee?
No, there's just the two.
Well, there's the audit fee.
The audit is statutory. Well, it's not statutory.
There's a fee on outstanding loans. Is there a fee on inventory?
No. We've backed both of these.
Okay.
Right.
It's on the record.
Yep, both of those have been backed out by
right.
prior motions.
Thank you. That was my question. Thank you, Madam
Chair. We've lost one member. Senator Dukes is going to have the.
Okay.
Just stand at ease for a second.
I'm sure we can do it.